Thanks for spending time with Fusion Community Church through our podcast. These can be accessed anytime through iTunes or on our website, fusioncommunitychurch.org. We hope you enjoy today's message from Pastor Andrew Fetter.
If you're new around Fusion, Barbara, for almost 4 years, sat in the role as my assistant, and a transition came in her life to be able to work alongside her husband. For those of you that work with your husband, you know that's can be a blessing and a curse, right? So it was an incredible opportunity. But I just want to say thanks to you. This is just a small gift. All right, you can sit down. But she stretched me and challenged me a lot over the last 4 years, and God used her in a lot of powerful ways during a lot of seasons of transition in the life of our church while we were mobile and trying to navigate all that, put all the teams in place and communicate with people. And some days we excelled, and other days we struggled, and other days we failed, right? And sometimes we fail forward. But I'm incredibly grateful to her role in my life and just how incredible she was at God using her to stretch me. And many of you have realized this now, but of course, we went about 7 weeks without someone in that role. And the staff of our church, both paid and volunteer, were kind of helping fill in those gaps during the week at the office. And they can attest that it was very, very difficult. We saw firsthand how much went on behind the scenes that we didn't even realize. And then Tina Hotelling stepped into that role, and Tina's been doing an awesome job for about the last 4 or 5 weeks. So she's loving it, and she's been a great addition to the team in filling that position. Well, today we're kicking off our fall series, and we've called it Trading Places. Oftentimes, we look at our lives and we wish we could trade places, but we don't think that's possible. And I'm here today and over the next 8 weeks to convince you that it is. That it is. That Jesus Christ came and lived and died and rose again so we could trade places with him. He took our place on the cross. And that was a symbol of every other area of life that Jesus wants to take our place. And oftentimes, we don't let him. We resist him. So, as we kick off this series, I want to do a couple of tests. Now, for those of you that are extroverts in the room, you're going to enjoy this. For those of you that are introverts, you're going to hate me, and you may not want to come back to church, but please come back. We're not going to do this every week, okay? But I want you to humor me a little bit. I want to ask you a question, and then I want you to turn to someone near you, preferably someone you don't know as well as maybe your spouse sitting near you, and engage with someone and answer this question. It's not a hard question. Okay, here's the question. I'm going to give you 1 second to think about it, and then I want you to turn towards somebody, all right, that's near you and tell them the answer to this question. I want you to tell them, what do you do? Okay, so ready? That's a pretty easy question. Go ahead. Tell someone near you, what do you do? Okay, now the other person can share what they do. And then come back and give me your attention. Sorry, no conversation, limits. I got to give defined limits, or the parking lot crew is going to be mad at me because we went over service again this week. So, okay, so what do you do? All right, so you've answered that question. How many of you kind of shared your career or that you're a stay-at-home mom? Okay, the majority of us. All right, same question, same person, different answer. Ready? Go. What do you do? Something you do, something you enjoy, a passion, a hobby, a pastime. Real quickly, one phrase, one sentence. Now the other person, share. What do you do? Okay, give me your attention. All right. Somebody shout out something you shared.
I crochet.
Crochet, okay. Somebody else.
Ride
snowmobiles. Okay, ready? Same question, same person. Round three, go. Something else you do.
I talk about teeth.
Okay. The other person share. All right, that's good. Give me your attention. Shout out something else. Cleaning up her messes, okay? What's that? Oh, my turn. I'm a pastor. I didn't get to tell anybody. Something else you do? Go to church on Sundays. Okay, cool. All right, round four. I think we're on round four. I want you to do it again. Something else you do? A hobby, something you enjoy, a TV show you watch, one of your favorite movies, a music, a song, whatever. Something you do. Okay, the other person? Okay, now give me your attention. That's four rounds. Seems like there's still plenty to talk about. Okay, All right, think for a second. I'm going to give you round five, something else you do. Come on, some of you, I heard Amanda say, oh my gosh, you do a lot. So you've got a big list, okay? All right, ready? Here we go. Something else you do. Go. Okay. Something else you do. Okay, great. Give me your attention. Now, what I'm subtly doing here is you're making a new friend, which is great, right? You're making a new friend. You didn't know you might have this conversation with the person in front or behind you. Now, chances are we could go on to round 5 and 6 and 7 and 8 and 9 and 10. And how do we know that? Because all of us admit our schedules are crazy. What do? I taxi my kids. What do? I like to go and have time of solitude at a coffee house and get coffee. I like to sit out on my porch and watch sunrises or sunsets. It's quiet time for me. All these things that we do, the big things, the little things, all these things we do. And we could go on probably for 20, 30, 40 rounds because we can just run through our schedule of Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. I serve at the church. I'm involved in this ministry. This is one of the things I do. I clean houses. I do this on the side. I have this hobby. I have this passion. All these things that we do. But I want to do test number two. And I'm going to ask you another question. Now, you can't use any of the answers from the first question because those are things you do. This question is, who are you? Ready? Go ahead. Same person. Who are you? Okay. All right. Give me your attention. How many of you used your name? You said your name. Who am I? Yeah. Names across the room. Okay. Some of you are like, good. If he does another round, I got something for the next one, right? Kind of giving you a cheater helps. Okay. All right. Round two. Who are you? Who you are? Tell somebody sitting next to you who you are. Who you are. Not what you do, who you are. Okay, give me your attention again. I don't want to give anybody cheaters on this one, okay? I want you to do round three. I want you to think of something else. If you were going to tell someone who you are, I want you to do it. That's all you can say. You can't say anything else or laugh about something they just said. Who you are. Go ahead, tell the person next to you. Who you are. Round three. Okay? All right, give me your attention. Round four, ready? Some of you are like, okay, can this be over? I got nothing else, right? Okay, we'll stop there. So I want to ask for a survey. How many thought the first question was harder? How many thought the second question was harder? Yeah. Who you are. Now I would say, between those two questions, we face a problem if our identity thing is not solved. If we don't know who we are, then what are we acting out on? If we don't know who we are, why are we doing what we're doing? We live in a culture that's obsessed with performance, right? So obsessed with what we do. And when we reflect on who we are, normally we have a hard time distinguishing who we are from what we do. In fact, normally as a default, we think the two are the same thing. What we do is who we are, but they're vastly different. And this question of who we are, it is incredibly important. And yet the ways in which we describe who we are in our world are pretty narrow and shallow. See, how we view our identity, who we are, is vital to every other area of our lives, and yet the things that influence the formation of our identity cause a lot of identity crises. The things that influence who we begin to discover that we are normally are the result or the implications of identity crisis moments. And so when we're in these identity crisis moments, we just kind of make a choice to go one direction. And we don't really reflect upon the destination that direction will lead us. For a moment, let's just kind of walk through life and reflect upon all the crises in life, the identity crisis moments where who you are is kind of in limbo and you've got to figure it out again. It begins as a young child in your home, right? And kind of initially, one of the defining characteristics of your identity is where you're at in the family. Are you the oldest? Are you the youngest? Are you the only child? Are you the dreaded middle child, right? Depends on where you're at. Are you fatherless? Are you motherless? Are you an orphan? Do you have a strong nuclear family around you? That influences who you are. You reach elementary school, right? And you begin to experience social situations and you begin to discover, am I the smart kid? Am I the funny kid? Am I the athletic kid? Am I the chubby kid? Am I the artistic kid? Am I the geeky or the dorky kid? You know, you look at those social circumstances when you were younger, when your kids are young, and you ask the question, are they a leader? Are they a follower? Are they a rebellious child? We begin to reflect upon the nicknames assigned to us. Nicknames at home, nicknames at school, nicknames with friends. And we have to ask ourselves, are those good nicknames? Did we like them? Were we favored in those nicknames? Or were they nicknames that were negative, that we hated when people brought up? Because it shapes who we think we are. You hit your teenage years, right? If you have teenagers, you know what this is like. Puberty sets in, a new school, education shifts. There's a little more independence. There's a little more personal responsibility. You enter into new social situations where there's not as much adult supervision. And you begin to wrestle with who you are now as your body is changing. You're surrounded by peers. Peers that want to speak into your life and shape you and influence you and pressure you. You're surrounded by tall adults, teachers, coaches, parents, neighbors. And they give you input. They speak into your life about who they think you are, who they think you should be. And so you have to process all of that. It's at this point in life when you're a teenager that what you wear becomes very important to you, right? Hygiene becomes important to you as a teenager, right? Hair care and your skin and acne and all those kinds of things. And for the first time in your life, things like creams and gels and lotions appear on your radar and they're stocked in your cabinet. You begin to wonder and ask the question based on culture that if you date or who you date, even in 7th or 8th grade, says a lot about who you are. It's not so much about who you're dating as much as who you're dating says about who you are, and you define yourself by it. We begin to size each other up. We compare ourselves to others, and we wonder, have I hit my growth spurt yet? Am I smaller? Am I bigger? We wonder, am I achieving or am I underachieving? We look at our grades academically. We look at our performance in sports. We look at our extracurricular activities. We measure ourselves against others. We ask, are we in the right crowd? Are we in the crowd we want to be? Are we kind of on the outside looking in? That develops and shapes our identity. We ask, are we winning or are we losing throughout high school? And then we graduate high school, right? You enter into the workforce or you go to college and you have this incredible opportunity, this window, that summer between high school and whatever the next step is, where you can redefine your identity. Some take advantage of it, some don't. Some just move forward with who they kind of think they are already. But you leave everyone that used to know you behind, and you go to a college, you go to a school where there's all new relationships. Sure, there might be one or two or three that know you there, but for the majority, it's all new relationships. It's new professors, new relationships, new coworkers if you're in the workforce. And they don't know the old you. You have this opportunity to start fresh. And so you ask these questions. What kind of friends do I want to make? What circle do I want to run in? Maybe I was geeky and I want to be athletic. Maybe I was the artistic and I want to be more the musical crowd. And so you begin to run with the athletic or the academic or the artsy group or the musical group. Or maybe you want to hang in an urban group or they're listening to pop music. Or you want to hang in a group that's more rural and they listen to country music because that's who you are. And then typically you make wardrobe changes accordingly, right? If you want to hang out with the rural group, you get those cowboy boots. If you want to hang out with the urban group, you buy skinny jeans. I don't know. You make lifestyle decisions. You make wardrobe decisions. You also make lifestyle decisions when you graduate high school. Will I go to church or not? Nobody's there waking me up. Nobody's there kind of press a thumb on me. Will I consider God? Will I follow God? Will I worship God? Will I interact and nurture my relationship with God or not? Will I drink or not? Will I party or not? Will I sleep around or not? Will I exercise or not? Will I be disciplined or will I be undisciplined? These are some of those identity things we deal with. Then you graduate college and you're a certified adult with a degree, with letters after your name, with a nice little thing you can hang on your wall, but a new identity crisis hits. Now I've got the degree. What am I going to do with it? Where am I going to work? Who am I going to work for? How am I going to use this degree? How is the cities or the locations that I look for work, how does that influence who I think I am? Where am I going to live? Am I going to make enough money to sustain my living? How long am I going to be single? Will I be single forever? And if you do discover your career job, which you're really, really passionate about, then a whole new identity shift begins to take place where now you define yourself based on what you do. Your identity comes into question. You fall into the same trap the rest of our culture comes out of, where we define ourselves what we do. I am a nurse. I am an attorney. I am a teacher. I am a coach. I am a technician. I'm an analyst. I'm a designer. I'm a chef. I'm a secretary. I'm an assistant. I'm an administrator, whatever it is. And then what you do begins to consume who you see yourself as. And then the next thing you do is to advance your identity because you define yourself based on your title or your role. And so you see an opportunity to move up. So you want to do whatever you have to do so that your identity can change and become a step higher, a title higher. But it's not until marriage does your identity really enter into a storm, right? A new crisis develops. Now I'm a husband. Now I'm a wife. And you thought you were marrying a person who was going to help you become everything that you want to be until you realize that they married you for the same reason. They want you to help them become everything they want to be. And all of a sudden you realize somebody's going to be a little bit disappointed. Somewhere there's going to have to be some compromise, some give. And suddenly two selfish people with separate identities collide into misery, and we call that marriage, right? It's a challenge. It's a challenge. And then what's the next logical step? Kids. All of a sudden, your identity is totally rocked. Because, yeah, you're a woman, you're a wife, and now your body is beginning to change. And that ties in directly with a lot of how you view yourself and your identity. You're showing, you're feeling different. You're turning into a mother. You're having emotional things going on, hormonal things going on. It's a whole new identity. The man is having more of a psychological and emotional transition happening, where now you're feeling the weight of responsibility, the weight to provide. I mean, there was one day where you were so in love and you could just like live in your car and you were in love together. And now you're like, I can't do that with a kid. I've got to provide. And so there's a whole nother level of stress, and it begins to stretch our muscles as men, emotionally, psychologically, because now we've got to care for our wife who's pregnant. We've got to nurture her during her pregnancy. We've got to give her foot rubs with no strings attached, or at least we should, right? And soon, your mom, your dad, the child is born. And what happens? This little thing becomes the center of which your entire life orbits around, right? That little baby determines when you sleep, when you eat. If you sleep, if you eat, right? Your world revolves around this baby. It changes your budget, changes your disposable income. What you used to call your free money now goes to diapers and formula. And that's just the beginning, right? Changes your priorities, changes your friendships, changes how you plan vacations, how you travel. I know that firsthand because if we are driving after 8 o'clock at night, the kids will not sleep that night in a hotel. We've learned that the hard way. So we have to stop. I want to press through and drive and get there. And no, we got to stop and get a hotel and unpack everything and put everybody down and get up and pack everything back up. And all the time we lose. Changes. Changes our schedule. Changes how life is organized. Changes how the house is organized. All of a sudden, your hobbies, your friends, your free time, the things that have defined who you are in flux. It's an identity crisis. And you either lose some of those things, or at least they're altered or affected in some particular way. Then the next stage, the kids get older. Some of you are in this stage, right? Now they're teenagers. Now they're gaining some independence. Now you're seeing them blossom before your eyes. You're seeing things that make you proud, and you're seeing things that break your heart. And you're caught in that tension of defining yourselves based on them or defining yourself some other way. They start to pursue their dreams. They begin to stretch their wings and fly. And they go through the identity crisis you once went through, but in a different changing culture. They graduate high school and they begin to be gone more than their home. And now they're not a consideration for dinner at night. They're not a consideration for planning and vacations and schedules. At least not as intentionally or as much as they once were, because things are shifting. Eventually, they move away from home. Maybe they move across town. Maybe they move across the country or across the world. Now the relationship is strained and you move into that empty nest season. Now there's a whole new identity crisis. Who am I without my kids here under my wing? Who are we in this marriage, in this relationship? What's the center of our world now that everything orbits around? How do we function now at this age without kids? Do I actually still like the person I married so long ago? Because sometimes we have these conversations in our minds, right? Well, we used to get along and kind of get past hard times for the sake of the kids. We wanted to stay together for the kids. We'd make money for the kids, and so we'd work all the hours we could work. And we used to go to church for the sake of the kids, and now that the kids are gone, who are we? What are we going to do? What's our identity? Do I like you? Do you like me? And then in addition to all those adjustments in life, all those identity crises we experience, we begin to get older. And now another shift takes place. The ones we used to care for are now caring for us. They're checking in on us. They're seeing how we're doing. the roles begin to reverse with our children. And then if your spouse passes, I mean, normally one passes before the other, now there's a whole new identity crisis. Who am I without this person in my life now? What is this home that we live in without that person here? What does my life look like without all of his doctor's appointments? What does my life look like without all of her routines going on in my life, day in and day out? Do I stay in the same home? It seems too big now for me to maintain alone. Do I move? Well, who am I now? What do I look like if I move out? What does that whole new transition look like? Do I need assistance now at this stage in my life? Many of you have shared you're going through that with your parents right now. It's an identity crisis issue. As health begins to deteriorate, then you even see the identity of that person that you once knew begin to deteriorate as well, to where they maybe don't even recognize you any longer. And that hurts them, it hurts you, it hurts everybody involved. Can anybody relate to these identity crises? And if we don't make a decision of who we are, we'll allow our circumstances and situations to define who we are, and we'll become reactional. So this is a very, very important question. Who am I? And if we don't choose to answer it and pursue who it is we long to be with intentionality, with strategy, with focus, we end up becoming someone over time that we don't like when we look in the mirror at them. We become someone sometimes we wish we hadn't. But there's a deeper problem here than not asking this question of who we are. I've kind of created a little tension in the room because we know what we do, but we wrestle with answering who are we. And yet there's something deeper than who are we, and it's asking the question, what shapes our identity? What shapes who we are? As we kind of discovered at the beginning of our message, in our culture, typically this is what we believe. It's on the screen. That what we do defines who I am. This is our default mindset as a culture. Let me give you four illustrations. One, let's talk about money. We have this thought that, you know, if I just handle money better, if I plan financially more, then I'm going to be less stressed. I'm going to be further ahead. I'm going to be better prepared. Maybe eventually I can even be debt-free. So if I do this, this is who I will be. Let's look at one that all of us struggle with at some point in life. If I exercise and diet more, if I just do that more, if I just stick with that, then I'm going to be at a lower weight. I'm going to be happier with my appearance. I'm not going to be as stressed. I'm going to feel better about myself. I'm going to feel better, healthier. I'm going to be able to fit in my skinny jeans that are in the closet and have been there for 7 years, right? I'm going to be, if you're single and wrestling with loneliness, I'll be more attractive to other men, to other women that might see me in a different light. If I could just exercise and diet more, it will change who I am. Let's talk about relationships. You know, if I just love my spouse more, we beat ourselves up with this. If I just love my spouse more, if I'm just patient more with her, with him, and if I just listen more to her or to him, or if I just talk more to her, or ladies, if I talk less to him, you know, we kind of go through that balance, or if I forgive faster and don't hold on to bitterness, if I do these things, then I'll be a better husband. I'll be a better wife. Who I am will change. I'll have a better marriage. And there's even spiritual implications with this. You know, and oftentimes we give each other this advice. You just need to pray more. You know, if you just do more for God, if you pray more, if you read your Bible more, if you come to church more, if you give more money, if you're more generous, if you listen to Christian music more, if you fast more, if you meditate more, if you worship more, if you do all those things, you're going to be closer to God and you're going to make God happier and you're going to be happier and you're going to have greater sense of fulfillment and satisfaction. And for most of us in this room, we see this, we're like, yeah, this is our default. This makes sense. If we set our mind to do these things, then we will become someone different. We'll reap the rewards of those behaviors. It makes sense. But what if I said the reason this makes sense to us is because this is the mindset of our culture? It's actually the end result of sin. What if I told you this pattern actually doesn't work? That the only reason we think it does is we come through the doors of church every Sunday so bombarded with this mindset in our culture that becomes our default. And it even becomes our default in our relationship with God and our relationship with each other. I want to give you some examples of how this doesn't work when we look at this list of four. Because there's things you've tried and tried and tried and tried and it's not caused a breakthrough in your life. Some of you here, you've tried to handle money better. You've tried to do it better. You've tried to plan, tried to be prepared, but it just doesn't last. Everything you try to do, it doesn't last. And you don't get further ahead, and you don't get out of debt, and you just seem to be stuck in old patterns. You shift back to prior behaviors. See, the issue is not what you do, it's what you believe about money. What you believe about money and what it brings you. Some of you have tried to exercise and diet for years and years and years, and you can't sustain that lifestyle. It just doesn't last. And you don't lose weight, and you don't feel better, and you still can't fit in those jeans, and year 8 comes, and year 8, 9, year 9 comes, and year 10 comes, and they just sit there, and then finally you give them Salvation Army, right? That's the process. Why? Why are we trapped by that? There's things we don't believe about food. There's things we don't believe about our free time. There's things we don't believe. Some of us, we've tried to love our spouse more. We've tried to be more patient. We've tried to listen more and forgive faster. And we've tried and we've tried and we've tried and we've tried all these things. We've tried to do, and yet the marriage hasn't gotten better, and our temper hasn't gotten better, and our ability to control what comes out of our mouth hasn't gotten better. If anything, after all that trying and trying and trying, we just feel more guilty and more beat up and more in bondage than we ever have. And if we're being honest, a lot of times the marriage is worse now than when we tried to do things different. And this even relates to God. Some people get discouraged. They've prayed more, and they've tried to read the Bible more, and they've come to church more, and they give more and serve more, and they do, and don't feel any closer to God. And a lot of times you still feel like you're a disappointment to God, like you're guilty, like you keep falling into the same sin pattern over and over again. And so you do to try to make yourself feel better, and you do, and you feel better for a minute, but then you fall into it again. See, this broken pattern of living, thinking that our doing precedes, defines our being, it's the dominant philosophy of our culture. It's how we think from the moment we're a child and we're raised, and it is a total lie, total lie. Most of our identity issues deal with these kinds of thoughts. How is what I do going to make me look? And how is what I do going to make me look to other people? We normally ask questions in our default that have to do with how we're going to appear to other people. Because we want to look well and we want them to think well of us. And so we perform and we do, even though if sometimes our heart's not connected to the doing. See, the truth is the only catalyst of real transformation occurs when we make internal changes to alter what it is we believe to be true. And the Bible's told us this for thousands of years, and yet sometimes we just seem to still miss what the Bible reveals to us, what God reveals to us. For those of you who have gone through recovery groups, The whole point of them is to begin to change what it is you believe. What it is you believe about your life, what it is you believe about that substance that you abuse and why you do it. It's to change the thought patterns accompanied with it so you no longer believe the lies that I need it to escape, but you see it for what it is. Well, if I use it to escape, I'm going to feel guilty again, and that doesn't give me escape anyways, and so it begins to change the way you think and what you believe about those substances. So dating all the way back to creation, in fact, the first sin of Adam and Eve in the garden was to believe. The very first sin in the Garden of Eden was to believe their doing could impact and change their being, who they were. We would call this later on in the New Testament a works-based gospel, a works-based theology of God, of salvation, where if we do it, we score enough points, and then we become like God. The Genesis creation account reveals that this lie, that our doing defines our being, that our doing precedes our being, this lie has existed all the way back to the very first sin in the Garden of Eden. In the creation account, we read on the sixth day God created mankind. In Genesis 1, verse 26, God said, "Let us make man in our own image, in our likeness." Think through the implications of this statement. You've probably read it 1,000 times before. Because you've committed to do more and to read the Bible more. And so you started in Genesis and you got through chapter 1 to this verse 100 times. But by the time you hit Leviticus, you just like abandoned it because you didn't know what was going on there. From the beginning, we see God the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Let us make man in our own image. We see a plurality in God, Father, Son, and Spirit. This Trinitarian theology we have in believing who God is. And regardless this morning of how familiar you are with the Bible or how long it's been since you were in church, probably most of us understand this one theme about the creation of man as told in Scripture. That the Creator designed man and woman in His likeness, in His image. We were created in His image. The implications of this are huge as it relates to identity. This is identity language. This is how God describes how were we created. The implications of this truth is that we were designed by God to be image bearers of His. That we were the pinnacle of creation, carrying the reality of who God is into creation. He didn't say that about anything else except for men and for women. And yet oftentimes we believe this lie. And many of us say, well, I saw a sunset and reminded me of God. And saw a sunrise and I saw the vastness of the mountains or the oceans. Or I was out in nature and I saw this little bird in a tree. And that's fine for that to remind you of God. But make no mistake, in Genesis 1, God says, no, my glory is to be carried. My image is to be revealed through humanity. We're the only piece of creation designed in his likeness. That from the moment Adam took his first breath, he didn't have to do anything. He was carrying the likeness of the divine creator. He was carrying the glory of God. And we are all still reflections of our creator, our divine creator. We still bear his image, but sin has marred the image. It's broken it. It's fractured it. It's made it cloudy. And that's what we read in Genesis chapter 3. The enemy of God shows up. And I want you to listen to the scheme he presents to Adam and Eve to cause them to disobey God. You've probably heard this verse 1,000 times, but there might be something new here that you haven't heard before. I know for me, it's something I've learned over the last 6 months, that I've seen this in a new way. Listen to the enemy of God's justification to Adam and Eve in Genesis 3, verse 1. One day, the serpent, Satan, asked the woman, "Did God really say you must not eat this fruit from any of the trees in the garden?" Eve responds, "Of course we may eat from the fruit in the eat fruit from the trees in the garden," the woman replied. "It's only the fruit from the tree in the middle of the garden that we're not allowed to eat. God said you must not eat it or even touch it. If you do, you will die." The perversion begins. "You won't die," the serpent replied to the woman. "God knows your eyes will be opened as soon as you eat it, and you will be like him." You'll be like God. Now see, here's the problem. With what we just read in Genesis chapter 1, God himself tells us we were made in his image. We were made like him. We were made to carry his glory into creation. Satan shows up and he says, "Well, if you do this, you'll be like him." Twists it. So Adam and Eve began to believe they were not like God. They believed God had lied to them. Even though God said they were made in his image, they believed the lie that they weren't like God, yet they had to do something in order to make themselves like him. And as a result, sin enters the world and it tarnishes our ability to bear the image of God in all of creation clearly without any cloudiness. See, our sin and rebellion against God, it changes and alters our ability to bear the image of the one who created us. Our sin is what prevents the glory of God from being revealed just by being human beings, just by being who we are. Now, if you're a Christian, if you're here this morning and you're a follower of Jesus, you need to understand the tension that you're living in. See, we live in a world that believes what you do precedes and defines who you are. And so that's why when you go to a party at work and you meet somebody new and you introduce yourself, "Hi, I'm Fetter," and they tell you your name, the first question we ask is, "What do you do? What do you do?" It's an easier question. It's not as vulnerable. It's not as transparent. And it's the first gut response that we have. We believe that what we do precedes and defines who we are. And yet, we practice a faith, grace, theology of salvation. So we live in this tension. In the world, we see that we're defined by what we do. And yet with God, we're actually defined by what he did for us and who he says we now are because of that gift. It's completely backwards. So we're locked in the tension between the two. And it trickles all the way back to the creation account where Satan first presented this lie. In Jesus, we see the fulfillment of this truth. I mean, Jesus comes, he offers us grace, gives us forgiveness. All of us who choose to believe, we believe in this internal regeneration, this internal realignment of what we think is true. And we're made right with God. That's what belief is. It's an internal realignment to what we believe is true. And that begins to change everything else. It's not by what we do for God. It's not by what we do for Jesus. It's not what we do for the Spirit of God. It's what he's already done for us. This is not by works so that no one can boast, right? That's what the New Testament says. So we don't and we can't do anything to save ourselves. That's why we need God to save us for himself. He's the one that's got to build the bridge. The Bible is very clear that the moment we believe, our identity shifts. We don't have to do anything. We reflected upon this last week. And that's why so many responded to be baptized. There was clarity around the fact that we get baptized not because our life is all cleaned up, but because we see that God is all cleaned up and he's the only one that can come in and change us from the inside out. And so people went public with their faith, realizing it wasn't the act of baptism that saved them. It was the grace of God. And they believed that his grace had been made available to them. Our identity shifts. The Bible says the old things are gone. Behold, all things become new. The Holy Spirit now dwells within us. We are the temple of the living God. And we've been resurrected from dead life to new life. See, the essence of the gospel is a reminder that we believe the power to change is rooted in belief. So when we change our alignment of what we believe to be true and we apply it to Jesus Christ, it begins to change everything else. But it's also the reminder that what we do does not have the power to change who we are. Romans 12:2 warns us, says, "Do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind." Your translation may even say, change the way that you think, change what you believe. Transformation is rooted in an internal realignment of our thoughts to that of God's thoughts, a realignment of our dreams and plans for our lives to God's dreams and plans for our lives. We don't really have to do anything. We have to change the way we think. It's an internal adjustment. Change our belief. I want to give you an illustration of what this looks like in our real life, because I understand it's kind of an abstract challenge I'm presenting here today. Let's say that tomorrow, Monday, you have a doctor's appointment. And your doctor comes and sits with you and pulls up close, eye to eye, and says, "I know this is your time for your physical, but there's something that doesn't look right to me, and I need to have you come back next Monday. We think you might have cancer." Whoa. If you trust your doctor and you believe that they know what they're doing, how much does your life shift in the next 7 days before that appointment? What you believe has the power to change what you do. You might have a hard time falling asleep that night. You might lose some sleep over the next week. If you're older and your kids are adults and there's been some fracture in the relationship with your kids, chances are in those first couple of days you reach out to them and say, "Hey, just want to let you know, this is what's going on. Got an appointment. I don't know what's going to come of it." And so not only does what you believe impact you, but now your kid who has a strained relationship with mom or dad, now it's impacting them and they're seeing maybe the window is shorter than it is long. Chances are you probably call the church office. You say, "Hey, can you add me to the prayer list? I'm dealing with something. I don't know what it is yet." You begin to make phone calls to people you care about. You begin, probably within the first day, you begin to alter your finances. You look at your budget and you begin to pull money out because you don't know what this is going to lead to. You don't know how you're going to cover it. And so you begin to tighten your belt immediately. It changes how you handle your finances. See, what we believe is true or what might be true has power to change what it is we do. What if you come the next Monday, the doctor says, "I'm just kidding, you're good. You can go home. It was just a big prank." Well, you would definitely find another doctor. That would be a reality. But in those 7 days, you are not the same person you were 7 days ago. Let me give you another illustration. You probably know someone in your life, some in this room right here, that have wrestled with that, with something like this, where they had a crisis in their moment, a health scare, had a slight heart attack or a mini stroke. And probably it was somebody that had that because they eat a lot of red meat and they didn't exercise regularly, right? Kind of like me. But after that crisis happened, what happened? The doctor sits down with them, tells them, "If you don't change your diet, if you don't begin to have more output and exercise, you're going to die sooner rather than later. This is going to come back. It's going to happen again. It's going to be more severe." And if they truly value their life and they believe what their doctor has to say, they have a lot more urgency to change dietary and exercise habits, right? That guy that you knew always had red meat, didn't do much. Now you know every time you go over to his house for a barbecue, he's got a turkey burger and he's taken a long walk every single day. His life has been altered by what he now believes and knows is true. Today, my goal is really to present a case to you, almost like an attorney would as we kick off this 8-week journey. And I'm suggesting to you that we have to nail down what it is we believe, our identity. And we have to remind ourselves of who we are in Christ as followers of Jesus every single day. You could even say we need to preach the gospel truth to ourselves all the time. And that alone has the greatest power to change our lives and behaviors forever. If we try to just kind of draw prescriptions about the external of who we are, it'll never change the internal, never. But if we revisit what we believe to be true and we align it with what God communicates to us in his word in every area of life, then that newness that God promises, our new being, the old dying, if we see ourselves for who he has recreated us in Christ to be, it will empower us to change everything that we do. If we know who we are, then we know what to do. But if all you do is beat yourself up with everything you think you need to do, and you've never done enough, and you never can stop doing, and you always feel guilty for not being good enough, or being a disappointment to God, or feeling like you've let God down, If all you focus on is what you got to do, and what you haven't done, you will fundamentally lead yourself away from being a Christian, because we believe fundamentally at its core that salvation is found in faith. It's what we believe. It's grace given to us freely. We can't do anything to earn it. We don't have a works-based grace. We have a faith-based grace. We believe God has already done everything that needs to be done through Jesus. See, God, throughout Scripture, he always begins with who we are first, like he did in Genesis 1. This is who you are. I've made you in my image. I've made you in my likeness. This is who you are. It's identity language. Now I've got stuff for you to do. And you'll always know what you need to do after you discover and cement who you are. So I'm inviting you into a challenge over the next 8 weeks. Today's really just been an introduction, a challenge to trade places, to take wherever you are and trade places with it. Jesus took your place on the cross. He paid the penalty for your sin, but that's not where salvation, that's not where the gospel ends. To be a disciple means you surrender every area of life to the lordship of Jesus Christ, where you say, I believe everything Jesus has to say about every area of life. And I'm encouraging you, be here the next 7 Sundays to be a part of this journey. And beyond that, I'm also encouraging you, because there's a lot more layers to this discussion than just showing up on Sunday and then going about your week back into a culture that lives opposite of what salvation is. I'm encouraging you to be involved in one of our life groups. I'm going to invite Sharon, our grow director, is going to come up and join me here. And we're just going to have a second where she's going to kind of talk a little bit, a little Q&A of what's coming up this fall. If you don't know Sharon, say, hey, Sharon.